Hello, this is your Polycast for Tuesday, April 28th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, more on the prospects for the Southwest Light Rail Line. Taxes and transportation are still big sticking points at the Capitol, and public and private land on a state hiking trail. The proposed Southwest Light Rail Line between Minneapolis and Eden Prairie appears to be in jeopardy. Governor Mark Dayton is questioning the viability of the project because the estimated price tag has ballooned to nearly $2 billion. It's the latest in a series of cost increases for what was already the biggest transit project in state history. Curtis Gilbert has more.
Metropolitan Council Chair Adam Dunick says he learned a week ago that his agency had underestimated the cost of Southwest Light Rail by more than $300 million.
There's not one or two things that seem to be the reasons that the cost went up. It seems to be a number of things, and it's shocking.
Environmental tests conducted last year revealed the soils along the 16-mile line were more polluted than originally believed. The ground was also less stable than planners assumed, which means pilings would have to be buried deeper into the bedrock below. Staff have also now pushed back opening day for the proposed line by a year, to 2020. That's if there is an opening day. Dunick told reporters he's re-examining whether light rail is the best option for improving transit in the Southwest Metro.
When I say all options are on the table, I mean all options do need to be on the table.
Including killing it.
That wouldn't be my first choice, but I think that we need to do the cost-benefit on whether it's worth doing or not.
The ballooning budget also means the Met Council will have to reapply for federal funding. The budget calls for the federal government to pay half the cost. State and local taxpayers have already poured close to $60 million into planning Southwest Light Rail. And Governor Dayton said in a statement today he won't support spending any more money unless he's, quote, satisfied that its cost can be justified and properly managed. He also called for a review of the capabilities and competencies of the Metropolitan Council staff to manage a project of this magnitude. Hennepin County Commissioner Peter McLaughlin has been one of the strongest supporters of Southwest Light Rail. McLaughlin acknowledges the rising costs are a huge setback, but he points out previous light rail lines have faced budget challenges too.
There are lots of times in these projects when you just want to throw up your hands and quit, and that's the nature of these things. And you got to have people involved who are committed to making these projects work. They're not going to quit, and they're going to figure out a way to make it work, and that's really where we are right now.
McLaughlin says planners should look for ways to scale back the project before they consider abandoning it. Southwest Light Rail faces legal challenges as well. Residents of Minnetonka and Minneapolis have filed lawsuits over the project's potential environmental impacts. Mary Paddock is a spokesman for the Lakes and Parks Alliance of Minneapolis. She hopes the increased costs will prove to be the death knell of Southwest Light Rail.
The project is ill-conceived from the standpoint of the environment, from the standpoint of it doesn't serve the people who need transportation the most, from the standpoint of cost, which is astronomical. So it's just riddled with problems.
A federal judge is expected to rule on the lawsuit shortly. If he sides with Paddock's group, it could cause additional delays and drive up costs even higher. Matt Look is an Anoka County commissioner. He's opposed Southwest Light Rail on the county's Transit Improvement Board, which would provide 30% of the money for the project. But Look says if Southwest Light Rail is going to be built, it shouldn't be delayed or allowed to exceed its budget.
At some point, we have to decide, look, if we're going to do a project, we're going to spend $8 billion or set a target. And if that means we can't have as many stations, if that means we can't have art, public art at the stations, which, believe it or not, is real, if that means you have to make some cutbacks, then that's what it means. That's reality. That's life.
2 years ago, the estimated price tag for the project was $1.25 billion. That number has been climbing ever since. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Governor Dayton said yesterday that the state needs an additional $7.3 million for its bird flu response. Tim Pugmire reports.
Dayton is asking the House and Senate to move quickly on the funding request for state agencies, which would cover the costs not eligible for federal reimbursement. During an executive council meeting, Dayton said the growing outbreak of avian influenza is devastating and alarming. He said he's also looking at providing some emergency financial assistance directly to affected turkey producers.
After the
depopulation and the composting occurs, and we're going to need some financial support for the purpose of surviving, literally economically, to come back.
State officials said during the meeting that the avian flu outbreak has been confirmed at 55 farms, with another 11 suspected. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
The Minnesota House has passed a higher education bill that would extend some, but not all, of the current tuition freezes for the next 2 years. State colleges would have flat tuition the first year and would see it decrease by at least 1% the second. Tuition at state universities would increase by a maximum of 3% the first year and would be frozen the second year. The bill has no freeze for the University of Minnesota. Even so, Republican House Higher Education Committee Chair Bud Nornes of Fergus Falls said he supports the university.
We want to do as much as we can for you. At the same time, I ask the regents to do as much for their students as they can. And if there's a tuition increase, make it as minimal as possible.
Budget plans from the governor and Senate Democrats would freeze tuition at Minsky and the U of M for the next 2 years. Democrats in the state Senate passed their transportation funding bill yesterday. The vote was 36 to 27, largely along party lines. That vote and another move underscored their differences with House Republicans on two major issues. DFL leaders also released a tax bill yesterday that provides a much smaller cut than the House version. Tom Scheck has more.
The Senate tax bill provides about a tenth of the direct tax relief proposed by House Republicans. While House Republicans have proposed a $2 billion tax cut for individuals and businesses, the Senate plan looks to hold down property taxes and provide a variety of tax credits. The credits include ones to encourage people to save for college and to create housing in areas of the state where there are more workers than places to live. Senate Tax Committee Chair Rod Scoy of Clearbrook says the bill would also give business owners a credit of $2,500 for every veteran they hire. Scoy says that will help veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan.
There's housing issues, there are mental health issues, and we really think that the best way to get at those is to help those young men and women get a job when they come back. And so we put a very significant credit in place to try to assist those folks.
Scoy says farmers and homeowners who see a sudden spike in property taxes will get help from the Senate proposal. And he says the statewide business property tax will be cut under his plan. Scoy says the bill also increases state aid to cities and counties.
We think it's really important to have a strong partnership with our local units. You know, we ask them to do a lot of services, to provide a lot of services to Minnesotans, and we want to be partnered.
The Senate bill also raises property taxes for railroads to offset the cost of grade crossing improvements. The plan does not include a proposal by Governor Dayton to increase the tax credit for child care. Senate Republicans are objecting to the increase in state aid to cities. And Republican Senator Julianne Ortman of Chanhassen says any tax talk should include transportation. Senate Democrats have proposed a transportation funding bill that increases the tax on gasoline to pay for road and bridge projects and adds a metro-wide sales tax to pay for transit. Ortman says the transportation taxes will hit lower-income Minnesotans the hardest.
Those folks that are trying to get to school or get to their first job, or there are folks that are unemployed and trying to pay for that tank of gas to get to their job interview, this is going to hurt the poorest of the poor.
But DFL Senator Scott Dibble of Minneapolis says the increased transportation funding is needed to pay for ongoing maintenance and new projects.
More than half of Minnesota's roads are more than 50 years old. 40% of the state bridges are more than 40 years old. And in just the next 3 years alone, 1 in 5 Minnesota roads will pass their useful life.
Both the Senate tax bill and the Senate transportation bill have to be negotiated with House Republican plans that are dramatically different. Republicans have proposed a transportation bill that relies on borrowing and dedicating sales taxes on auto parts, leased vehicles, and rental cars to pay for road and bridge projects. The $2 billion Republican tax cut includes a temporary personal income tax exemption and cuts to the statewide business property tax. It also cuts taxes on veteran retirement benefits and Social Security income. Republican Tax Chair Greg Davids of Preston says he believes he and Rod Scoy can reach a deal in the 3 weeks that remain in the session.
I know that we're not going to be doing $2 billion, and he knows he's not going to be doing $200 million. So somewhere in between there, we'll find a sweet spot, and then we'll put the tax bill together.
The House is scheduled to vote on its tax bill on Wednesday. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News, at the Capitol.
Conflicts between hikers and a private landowner along the north shore of Lake Superior have led to the closure of a popular section of the Superior Hiking Trail. It's the first time a private property owner has essentially kicked out hikers since the construction of the trail began nearly 30 years ago. Dan Crocker has the story.
Randy Bowe owns 380 acres of land between two very popular state parks, Gooseberry Falls and Split Rock Lighthouse. The Duluth taxidermist bought the property in the mid-1980s, just when work on the Superior Hiking Trail was beginning. He granted permission for a 1.6-mile section of trail to cut through his property. But as the trail has gotten more popular, he says problems with hikers have increased.
Numerous times I've found basically smoldering campfires, left by people, which in a dry spring like this could be a problem.
He says hikers have berated him for driving an all-terrain vehicle.
Yeah, I've had people, cuss me out, my daughter and I riding our ATVs on our existing trails on our property.
And the last straw, he says, was last fall when hikers harassed a friend he had invited to hunt.
He encountered three male hikers who pretty much read him the riot act, called him every name in the book, followed him to his stand and stood around his stand for almost an hour howling like wolves.
So beginning Friday, hikers will no longer be allowed to hike through his property. Instead, they'll have to detour on the paved Gichigami State Trail to the Split Rock River, a total of about 6 miles, or follow a shorter 2.8-mile detour along both the bike path and a stretch of gravel county road.
It's really hard because it's kind of right in the heart of the trail. It's on the northern boundary of Gooseberry Falls State Park.
Gail Coyer is executive director of the Superior Hiking Trail Association, a private nonprofit that maintains and manages the trail. She says the group now faces two challenges: planning and constructing a new section of trail, and in the short term, communicating the detour to hikers.
We work so hard to have this continuous trail so hikers can just have this seamless experience, and so now it's challenging. There's more choices for hikers to make. There's more communication effort that needs to go on to let people know, what the issues with the trail are.
The Superior Hiking Trail extends 300 miles from Jay Cook State Park, south of Duluth, to the Canadian border. It mainly traverses public land, but it does cross about 50 sections of private property. Landowners can ask the Trail Association to post private property signs so hikers know to respect the rights of the property owners who've granted trail access. That's what Bo did. But Andrew Slade, author of Hiking the North Shore, says some hikers don't understand the distinction between public and private land.
A lot of people think, well, it's the wilderness. People don't understand that there's, the North Shore is really this patchwork of private land and public land. And just because there's no, picket fence or even no trespassing signs doesn't mean that you can do whatever you want.
Some landowners have granted permanent easements to the Trail Association, but others, including Randy Bowe, only granted permits that they can revoke at any time. The Superior Hiking Trail Association is working to make those agreements permanent. But Randy Bowe says he's not going to change his mind.
My family and I spent many a sleepless night trying to figure out what to try to do and rectify these problems. Now it got to the point where, unfortunately, it's a few people that ruined it for everybody.
The Superior Hiking Trail Association hopes to eventually reroute the trail across state and county land to the west of Bowe's parcel, but the detour will be in place at least for several months. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Two Harbors.
And that's your Polycast for this Tuesday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom.